The date is October 8th, 1993, and we're watching Demolition Man. Welcome to I Used to Like This One.
Hello, and welcome back to I Used to Like This One, the show where we take a look at movies we remember fondly from our childhood and attempt to look past the nostalgia to see if they still hold up. I am your host, Sean Wells, and with me is my co-host,
Colin Stewart.
And this week, we brought in another guest star, so we are joined in studio by Tyler Warawa. Tyler, how are ya?
I'm great. How are you guys doing?
Not too bad. As good as anyone can be in 2020, I guess, right? So this week, we're looking back at October 1993, when the movies and theaters were Cool Runnings, Dazed and Confused, The Good Son, Nightmare Before Christmas, Rudy, Return of the Living Dead, Mr. Nanny, and of course, our movie for today, Demolition Man, which earned $159.1 million on a $57 million budget.
That is such a good lineup. I love The Good Son, and now I'm thinking we need to go and do that one at one point.
Need to do The Good Son?
Yeah. But as always, this movie is 27 years old, so there will be spoilers. So if you don't want it to be spoiled for you, hit pause, go watch it, then hit play, and come back and hear what we have to say.
Thanks for mansplaining that to us. The tagline that appears on the poster for this movie is, "The future isn't big enough for the both of them." But that's definitely less of a description and more of a teaser. So we go to Colin for our 60-second synopsis.
So, Demolition Man tells the story of John Spartan, a risk-taking police officer who has a reputation for causing destruction while carrying out his work. After a failed attempt to rescue hostages from evil crime lord Simon Phoenix, they are both sentenced to be cryogenically frozen in 1996. Phoenix is thawed for parole hearing in 2032, but escapes. Society has changed and all crime has seemingly been eliminated. Unable to deal with a criminal as dangerous as Phoenix, the authorities awaken Spartan to capture him again. Straight from Wikipedia.
Oh, you didn't even write that one today. Okay. So, I know that for me, this is the movie that I most associate with Sylvester Stallone. You know, like, I know that's probably blasphemous to say, but, like, my experience with Sylvester Stallone up until the point that this movie came out was very limited. It was after I saw this movie that I went back and saw Rambo and all his other movies. But Tyler, you're our guest today. Now, when I proposed that you join us on the show, I gave you a few options of movies, and you just jumped right on Demolition Man, saying it was one of your favorites. What is it about this movie?
It's a really good blend of humor and action.
Yeah.
It's a very satire-esque movie. If you look at all the other action movies that came out around the same time, this just like completely makes fun of them in
That's
a really
true, yeah.
smart way.
Yeah.
And there's like, this is like Sandra Bullock's big break.
She was in Speed before this. This was
after.
Was it after? Okay. Yeah. See, I was thinking this was when she was riding that Speed wave.
No, but Speed was 94.
Okay. Right. Yes. Oh, I feel bad about that. Okay. So Speed was because of this movie. Then let's put it that. Let's think about it that.
Well, there's actually a funny story of Rob Schneider's also in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And he, I read a thing where he was talking to Sandra Bullock, and she was mentioning this bus movie that she was going to go film after this. And he was like, it sounds stupid. You shouldn't do it. And then Speed ends up being one of the top grossing movies of the next year. So.
Yeah. Colin, Demolition Man, what is your experience with this?
So I have probably only watched Demolition Man once in my teen years before this. I watched it because I loved Blade.
Okay.
And I really liked Wesley Snipes. So I was like, oh, that looks like a cool movie. And Simon Phoenix looks so awesome. So I decided to watch the movie. But I agree with you. It was probably one of the first Stallone films that I watched. Like, I had never seen... I still haven't seen Rambo. Ugh. I don't know why I shouldn't say that, but I haven't seen a lot of Stallone movies outside of Demolition Man and Rocky. Yeah, no, I guess,
let me just make a note of that one for the future. Maybe we'll take a look at Rambo. Okay, well, let's jump into Demolition Man. It is directed by Marco Brambilla, who is making his directing debut in this one. He's also known for movies like Dinotopia, Excess Baggage, and he also directed a Kanye West featuring Dwell? Are any of you Kanye West fans that... Okay, Dwell.
What's the song?
It's Power.
Okay, yeah, I know that song.
Okay. It's a good song. Yeah, I'm not a Kanye West guy, but yeah, he was the director of that music video as well. It's produced by Steven Brattner, who has 6 producing credits, and Pete Catalano, who has 3. Nothing worth mentioning. And written by Peter Lankov, who was one of the writers on Son-in-Law, Universal Soldier 2 and 3, not the first one, RIPD, 24, CSI New York. He's also this guy that he has revamped all these old TV shows, so he's the guy in charge of Hawaii Five-O, Magnum P.I., MacGyver, and also written by Robert Renault, who did Action Jackson, an episode of Tales of the Crypt, an episode of The Hitchhiker, nothing much with him. We open the movie on a view from behind the Hollywood sign, which is burning, and we are told that it is the year 1996. We find out more specifically November 20th, 1996 is when John Spartan gets sentenced to his cryo prison. We follow a military helicopter over the Los Angeles skyline, which is also where we see multiple other fires burning in Los Angeles. So a very bleak look at Los Angeles 3 years in the future for these guys.
I was going to say, the movie comes out in 1993, and this is their vision of 1996. Like, yeah. What was happening in 1993? I don't remember.
Well, how have things evolved?
Yeah, that would have been not riots? Too... Yeah, it would have been not too long after riots and Rodney King and all that. Maybe.
There are actual scenes in this movie that are from the Rodney King riots.
Oh, okay. So one of the helicopter pilots comments, "Remember when we used to, when they used to let commercial airliners land in this town? It is a very bleak future, and this is pre 9/11. So we get a brief glimpse of this future, but now we're on the helicopter and we meet our hero John Spartan, the Demolition Man, played by Sylvester Stallone, who is of course Rocky, Rambo, and Oscar, if you've ever seen Oscar. Who is on a mission to apprehend this criminal Simon Phoenix. They know where he's hiding out, and a thermal scan of the building shows he is without hostages like they thought. So he jumps out of the helicopter attached to a tether with almost no elasticity. Is this actually how Army Rangers do this?
Well, the stunt, they had to do it that way because like the risks of using a bungee cord is that if it came down, like... He could fly down and go back up into the helicopter blades.
Well, see, a bungee I could understand. Rappelling I could understand. But this is like this weird hybrid of the two methods. Yeah.
Whoever did the stunts looked like they got intense whiplash.
Yeah, I feel like he would have broken his fucking back. I mean, yeah. Like,
I think it was a record-setting bungee jump from a helicopter that time, too.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
He finds Simon Phoenix in this warehouse that he has jumped into. Played by Wesley Snipes, who, of course, like Colin mentioned, is in Blade. He's also in Passenger 57, New Jack City, White Men Can't Jump, The Art of War, which is one that I just sneak in there because I really liked The Art of War. That was one that came out around the same time as Mission Impossible 2. And I remember I worked at a video store at the time and I used to tell people, this is what Mission Impossible 2 should have been, is The Art of War. But he is dressed very 90s with his checkered leather jacket and his striped pants and looking like Dennis Rodman with his hair.
I got a point to
the
reason Dennis Rodman dyed his hair blonde was because of Wesley Snipes' character in this movie.
What? Okay, yeah. So he rocked that look forever. He was a huge
fan of this movie.
Okay. Yeah. I find it funny that you mentioned Blade earlier, and then this was your inspiration to see Demolition Man, because, like, Blade is so stoic and serious, and Simon Phoenix is basically just a comic book villain. He's the Joker. Yeah. He's the Riddler.
But I think Simon Phoenix is Blade with blonde hair, basically. They have almost the exact same haircut.
Yeah, that's true. He's bantering with John Spartan, saying stuff like, "You're up to your ass in gasoline, set your ass on fire," or talking about his hostages. The everyone stopped coming down here, but the bus drivers just wouldn't listen. I must say, now that I'm at an age where I am a bus driver, this is a little bit more terrifying. Yeah. Like, working in the pandemic, I have to admit...
Are you a rogue bus driver? Would you just be going into places where you shouldn't be going?
If my dispatch tells me where to go, that's where I'm gonna go.
If the route goes through a war-torn wasteland governed by a crime lord, you're going.
Do you have to cringe when they tell you to go to Northeast Edmonton?
I might call in sick if I had the war-torn route. But so we also get the foreshadowing line of "I swear I'd lose my head if it wasn't attached." Classic. So they fight. The whole place is set on fire, and John and Simon get out of there. The whole place explodes impressively. And I love that they, like, actually demolished a building for this. This is something that newer movies, they would have gone all CGI.
Yeah.
I love a practical
explosion. I read a thing that said MTV held a contest to, like, decide if you won, you were the person who got to press the button that demolished that building.
Oh, that would have been awesome.
That was the first building they demolished in Los Angeles in, I think, 20 years.
Wow.
Prior to that.
Oh, wow.
Also, it was coming down anyways, but the Demolition Man production team decided to throw a ton of gas into that building.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I don't know that every explosion has so much flames.
Well, and it's even as he's running down the hall, we see the flames coming up in the background, and then they show the front of the building, and all the windows burst out in flames. I don't actually understand how he got out of there unscathed.
It's not explained. It's not in the movie.
Yeah.
They just show up.
So we find out that the hostages were actually there, and Simon tells John Spartan that they were already dead. So we think this is what it is, but Simon Phoenix drops a bombshell later in the film that Spartan was actually responsible for all these people's death. But the other cops...
The opposite way around.
Opposite.
At the beginning point, he says to the police chief or whatever, like, "Oh, I tried to tell him and he wouldn't listen," and then explode. It's later on in the movie that he tells John Spartan when they're at the car that everyone was dead anyways. That's why they didn't see
No, he it. Says that everyone was alive, I thought. And that but it was when he's in the room full of gasoline, he says that, I don't know.
It's revealed that they were
revealed that they were alive. So, and the other cops believe Simon Phoenix.
Yeah.
Right? Like, he comes out and says that there were no hostages in there, and Simon says, "No, there were, and I told him, and he just didn't care," and all the cops believe him, and he gets charged on the word of this crazy criminal.
Anyways, you're both frozen now.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Yeah. And I like how they both get, like, seemingly equal sentences for manslaughter and everything that Simon Phoenix has done.
Spartan gets 70 years for involuntary manslaughter.
Yeah.
That seems
a little steep. Yeah. So John Spartan gets sentenced to the new cryo prison, where he will be frozen for his jail term and implanted with a subliminal behavior modifier. Why does he keep saying "skip it" in the beginning? They're reading off his charges and he's just "skip it."
I think, like, it's just because he's so badass. He doesn't want to hear.
He doesn't care. He knows he's going in.
Yeah. And what is that cryo juice? Like, did any of you happen to watch The Floor is Lava on Netflix? Yeah. Doesn't that look like clear lava?
Pretty similar. I think how they did that scene in the movie is they used like a gel.
Yeah.
And they threw a Sylvester Stallone dummy in there.
Yeah.
Like, I was going to say, what it reminds me of is You know when you get like HelloFresh or whatever, and the gel that comes in the cold gel packs?
Ice packs, yeah.
There's also a lot of strategic movement by Sylvester Stallone to make sure that the camera didn't catch his like biscuits, like his balls. Like...
There's one shot I think you can see them sort of in shadow. So now we time jump to August 3rd, 2032.
That's 12 years from now. Just
so. I know, right? So it kind of bugs me when movies pick a future that is a little closer than it should be. Like Blade Runner, that time has already passed for the first Blade Runner. You know, like Back to the Future Day has already passed. And so now we're 12 years away and it's nowhere close to they have in the movie. I disagree.
I feel like we're on our way.
There's some things, yes. I just, you know, I think a year like 2060 would have been a better choice. You know, just give it a little bit more time. But we are now in San Angeles, California, because the big one of 2010 changed the world. And this city is now part San Diego, part Los Angeles. We are now getting a taste of what 1993 thought the future technology was going to look like. And their first prediction, self-driving cars. So they're actually pretty close.
Good job, Elon Musk.
It is being driven, or I guess ridden, by Lenina Huxley, who is played by Sandra Bullock from Speed 1 and 2, Miss Congeniality 1 and 2, and The Blind Side, who is a cop, and she's checking in with the cryo prison as part of her daily duty. She's disappointed to find out that it's another beautiful, crime-free day. And she gets into the precinct to find that there was a major disturbance of graffiti that day. How cool is that graffiti and anti-graffiti technology? I think it's pretty cool. We also get a quick look at the Wasteland Scrap making their plans for their heist later on. So we get into the office with Lenina, and she greets her co-workers with the touchless, almost high-five type greeting, which really couldn't be more relevant in a COVID world. I feel like this handshake, I think they've predicted what our future greetings are going to look like after this pandemic is over. This is where we meet Alfredo Garcia, played by Benjamin Bratt, who was also in Miss Congeniality, Traffic, Clear and Present Danger, Catwoman. And as we mentioned in our Mortal Kombat episode number 6, he's the husband of Princess Kitana, Talisa Soto. We get to meet Irwin, played by Rob Schneider, who was from SNL and all the Adam Sandler movies. And Chief...
Was this Rob Schneider's best role, do you guys think?
I don't know. You can do it.
You can do it. It's pretty good.
I'm pretty fond of Deuce Bigalow.
I have to admit, I have a soft spot for Deuce Bigalow. Even the animal sometimes. It's
was
another
this
good
one
demo.
Of his early movie roles, though?
Yeah. I think he was still on SNL when he was doing this.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out where this movie places in his career.
He's still trying to do non-really radically bizarre roles at this point in time.
And we also meet Chief George Earl, played by Bob Gunton, who has 137 credits, he has such a variety of credits. He was in Daredevil, the Netflix one, not the shitty Ben Affleck one. He was on 24, he was in Ace Ventura, When Nature Calls, and of course, probably one of his most recognizable roles, he was the warden in Shawshank Redemption. We get a little peek at Lenina Huxley's obsession with the 20th century, and how much more of a rebel she is compared to people like Alfredo Garcia. Simon Phoenix, for some inexplicable reason, is up for a parole hearing, so... I'm wondering, is this because he has Cocteau?
I have to think this is part of the plan.
This is part of the plan.
I don't understand how Phoenix would be up for parole, yet Spartan is just left to be frozen.
Yeah. So he's, inexplicably up for this parole hearing, and we get our first taste of something not really being on the up and up with his situation, because he knows the voice command that will set him free from his restraints, Teddy Bear. But he doesn't know how he knows. And we get our first Simon Says. The Simon Says, I get sick of the Simon Says. Simon Says, die.
I was going to say, I feel like he doesn't do it enough for it to be...
A thing?
A thing. It's almost like maybe he did it more originally, but they cut some out. Because there are times where he does it, but then there are other times that he theoretically should do it, but chooses not to for whatever reason.
Yeah, I guess if you're going to go full comic book villain, you...
This is one movie I really would have liked to see, like, an extended director's cut.
Yeah.
Because they did a lot of editing, and they cut a lot out of this movie.
Okay. Yeah.
And what you're probably going to talk about next will demonstrate that.
Well, I didn't come across anything like that myself. So coming up next, he murders everyone around him, digs out the warden's eye to escape through the retinal scanner. But yeah, he uses the retinal scanner to get through the locked door. The alarms start going off at the police station. There's been a code 187, which they have to look up. And it's a murder death kill. We find out that there hasn't been a murder in 16 years. So that's 2016. I just want to highlight that for a second. 2016 was the last murder in San Angeles. So Simon escapes in a stolen car. The police are dispatched and meet up with him at an information booth where he's trying to find the location of Edgar Friendly, because that name is stuck in his head for some reason. And also he's looking for guns. Also, at this point, we get introduced to my favorite running joke, which is the fines for the violation of the verbal morality code. I guess, sorry, Lenina swears with her sanctimonious asshole in the previous scene. But this is where we really get it drilled in. I love the verbal morality code.
It's the toilet paper dispensers.
Yeah, turns out. it's my favorite running joke. But I also enjoy the weird mishmash of technology in this movie, because some of the things seem legit, like the car, but then he starts searching through files, or the police are searching through files, and it has like this weird animation scape that it goes through to... I guess that's what they thought the computers would be like in the...
That's what I think UI they wanted it to be. It was going to be like goofy animations and everything. Now it's like, no, just keep it simple. You know, I get annoyed when my computer boots up and I have to watch half a second of a Microsoft logo spinning around.
But and even when the cops surround him, the one cop pulls out this bulky handheld device, and so you can tell that this is pre-smartphone, even pre like hand size cell phone, like, yeah, Palm Pilot, because he's got this weird, like, it's like the size of a tricorder from Star Trek. They are told by dispatch to approach with extreme assertiveness, and so he asks this Palm Pilot thing what to do, and you know, the maniac is present. And so this thing tells him to tell the maniac to lie down with hands behind his head, to which Simon responds sarcastically, and the cop says the maniac has responded with a scornful remark. So now the device says, in a firm voice, demand maniac lie down, and add the words, or else. And so this is a trigger for Simon, and he takes care of the police quite easily, because the cops in the future are useless. And he knows the code to override the anti-graffiti wall that one of the cops happens to be standing right by. Lucky sevens. And they are armed only with glow rods. Like, they're like bobbies.
Well, my favorite part of that whole scene is when Rob Schneider's like, we're police officers. We're not trained to deal with that kind of violence.
That's right.
And I was just like, how relevant for today's time where it's like...
Yeah, that too. Yeah, absolutely. Defund the police and all that. And so in this fight, Simon jumps up on one of the cars and he smashes the windshield. Now, I hate when windshields in movies smash like normal glass.
Yeah.
I wish that they had like figured out a way to do something that's going to pebble up like an actual windshield would, or you know, or stay intact like an actual, like, you'd think that the windshield technology would be even better than it is now in the future. But he taunts the cops like a comic book villain, uses a glow rod to overload one of the cop car's fuel cells, and causes a major explosion. Then we cut to a scene where we meet to Dr. Raymond Cocteau, who is played by Nigel Hawthorne, who has 155 credits dating back to 1956. He was in The Madness of King George, Amistad, Gandhi, and three different Shakespeare movies. And he is in a meeting blaming Edgar Friendly for these recent disturbances in the city. I'm not sure whether these the TV screens that they have in the conference room, I don't know whether these are cool and modern or whether they're a bad technology that someone in 1993 came up.
They're like with. An enhanced Zoom meeting.
I guess yeah. So. Yeah. So, you know, them each having their own little stand with their face on it, it's kind of an interesting way of doing meetings. Yeah. Associate Bob comes in, who is played by Glenn Shaddix, who is from Meet the Applegates, Heathers. And, of course, he was Ortho in Beetlejuice. I think that's probably something that people know him the best for. And so much voice work. He has a lot of voice work. He comes in to report about the prison escape. So Cocteau now tells the cops to apprehend Simon by any means necessary. And the cops are at a loss of what to do. But the old cop, Zachary Lamb, played by Bill Cobbs, who has 200 credits. I didn't even pick any out. Tells them that in the end, it came down to one man, John Spartan. And so they watch archive footage of John Spartan's arrests, and Lenina Huxley gets a bit of a lady boner over it. And I just want to point out that Sylvester Stallone is 18 years older than Sandra Bullock.
I'd also like to point out that could have been used for the WAP music video when she sees that.
The WAP? What?
Oh, the new Cardi B song. That's so con.
Wow, no, I, wow, Cardi B, like, wow.
Sorry, I'm 34. what is a Cardi B?
Okay, well, I'm a little more advanced than that. I've heard of Cardi B, but...
All right, this song's called Wet Ass Pussy.
Okay. Okay.
It's kind of blown up because, like, Ben Shapiro picked up on it, and he criticized it, and I guess his wife's a doctor, and they're inaccurate medical terms being thrown around during this Cardi B song.
Mm. I see, and I don't think you ever want to associate an ass with a pussy anyway. They're two separate entities.
I don't think anybody's depending on Cardi B for their medical
information. The problem is that kids today probably do. So their plan, they decide to thaw out John Spartan, but Chief Earl treats him like shit, even though his charge was involuntary manslaughter, like we said. But it's just because Chief Earl just does not like the idea of thawing out an old-fashioned cop to catch an old-fashioned bad guy. But they recruit him to apprehend Simon Phoenix. So Sylvester Stallone is brought into the station, and he doesn't know how to use the three seashells. Is this another COVID prediction that toilet paper is sacred?
Well, I mean, it could have been a prediction had the world ultimately run out of toilet paper completely. But we were saved from that. So
you could probably do an entire podcast on the three seashells.
Well, okay.
Yeah, just speculation.
You should have known this question was coming, though.
Explained what they're for, so maybe just round table, like...
Yeah, any guesses?
Theories on the use.
The most plausible one I've seen is that you use the first two seashells to pull your poop out, and then the third one to scrape.
But the one I read was like, you hold the first two together, like almost in a weird blade, and then, so, like, presumably, you would then, like, swipe it down, which I find is not going to be pleasant, and also just very, very strange.
Well, now, with the idea of scraping, I mean, we don't actually, they're not actually seashell, I don't think.
And then, right? don't they go from small to large?
Because he says they're
I think they're all the same size.
Yeah, he says that they're these seashell-type things. So, like, I don't think they're actually seashells. So are they rubberized then if they're for scraping? But how is that sanitary? Is the shelf something that sanitizes them?
Yeah, that's a really good
point. I still wouldn't want to use a public washroom if I'm using the same butt scraper that everyone else is. Like, I want to know how the three seashells
It's the future.
Are.
Don't they just have a bidet? I would just assume.
Oh, I know.
Like, they'd have the most advanced bidet technology.
Or it's an actual shell game, and you have to pick is three seashells. And only one of them has the button for the toilet paper underneath it.
So John Spartan gets reunited with Zachary Lamb. Everyone is appalled at how they interact because they touch, and John gets they swear with each other and insult each other.
There's an important plot point here as well that when he awakens, he asks about his wife, and we find out that she died in the big one of 2010.
Yeah,
but then he also talks about his daughter. And Huxley tells him his daughter is still alive, but then this point just continue, it gets brought up and ignored over and over until, like, Tyler's point about stuff that got cut out. This is one of those things.
If you want to get really dirty, there's a plot theory that Huxley's actually, or she's his daughter.
Yeah, I read that.
Okay. That's like
That's
that
really
movie.
dirty. It's
Yeah,
like,
it's like that Josh Brolin movie. What, Old Boy is it called?
oh yeah.
Yeah. So when he swears at Zachary Lamb and the thing on the wall goes off, he gets the idea that he can make his own toilet paper by swearing at the fine machine. And so he says, "Thanks a lot, you shit brain, fuck face, ball breaking, duck fucking pain in the ass. So much for the seashells. See you in a few minutes." Oh, I had to write that down.
The
I
writer
had
for
to
that
know.
hat should have gotten a bonus.
So after using the bathroom, John Spartan ends up telling the other cops that Simon will look for guns. And so they end up heading to the museum also because Spartan has a hunch. I don't understand why John Spartan offers to drive. Like, not just because of the fancy futuristic cars, but shouldn't he realize that the fact that the city is now called San Angeles, that he probably won't know his way around? Like, is he just filled with that much machismo that he has to, that he feels the need to drive?
One of the skills he was imbued with when he was frozen was misogyny plus. Can't let the woman drive.
But to counter it, he was also made a seamstress. So the misogynistic seamstress.
So in the car, they turn on the radio to listen to the number one oldies radio station, which plays mini tunes, or as they called it in Spartan's day, commercial jingles. And that means it's time for Sponsorship Corner! Oh, I am excited about today's Sponsorship Corner. So, Demolition Man, for anyone who is familiar, is definitely a little sneakier with the product placements, unlike many of the other movies we've talked about, because you have to listen as much as you watch. But here are the ones that jumped out at me. Demolition Man is brought to you by Alka-Seltzer, Armor Hot Dogs, Cadillac Oldsmobile, so Cadillac slash Oldsmobile, Green Giant, Pepsi, Kennel Rush Dog Food, Bud Light, Rolex, Oscar Mayer, Pennzoil, Sara Lee, Marlboro, and of course, Taco Bell. But also, it is worth noting that in Lenina Huxley's office at the precinct, she has a Lethal Weapon 3 poster, a Red Hot Chili Peppers poster, and a Joker and a Batman figurines on the shelf, which are all distributed by Warner Brothers, the same team that did Demolition Man. The song that Lenina plays in the sex scene is the Love Boat theme, which was on CBS, which is a Time Warner company. And also, oh, this gets even better. Also on the subject of Warner Brothers, when they're in the sewers later, there's an area where there's a video store. And on the rack, you can see copies of the movie Presumed Innocent, Batman Returns, My Blue Heaven, and Passenger 57. Sound familiar?
Wow.
Yeah, so they've actually got a Wesley Snipes Warner Brothers movie on the shelf. It's hard to make out. There were several others on the shelf that I couldn't quite make out. Like, I just recognized those distinct covers enough that I knew which movies those were just by seeing them. Except for some reason, Chaplin is on the shelf, which is a Sony TriStar movie. I tried to find if there was some sort of connection to the production team in this movie, but I couldn't find one. And one more, Lenina Huxley also has an Oakland Raiders helmet behind her desk, which I tried to find if there was a Warner Brothers connection there as well, but no luck. However, ironically, in the 2000s, Warner Brothers did produce a series of documentaries about the 90s Oakland Raiders. So maybe they predicted the future again by knowing that they were going to be doing these documentaries. But this has been Sponsorship Corner. And And I think that is the biggest one so far. That is a huge one. Bill and Ted's was big, but wow.
Yeah, there's a lot of product placement. Taco Bell is the only company they could really find that would allow them to be in this movie because it was R-rated.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
They originally wanted Burger King to win the franchise wars, but they passed and so did McDonald's, so they went with Taco Bell.
I would be interested if these franchise wars were actually wars. Like, you know, you've got Ronald and Grimace out there fighting the Taco Bell dog.
Yeah, like
Bell dog is just vicious and tears Grimace to shreds.
It would be interesting to know how it was contested and if it was based on, like, a mass, just everybody bring your signature burger, and America will decide. But then Taco Bell doesn't even have burgers, so maybe that alone set them apart.
They won a reality show, you know.
But
so you think you can fast food or something? Yeah.
Interestingly enough, in the rest of the world outside of North America, Pizza Hut
was yes.
The restaurant that won the franchise wars. And it's if you watch something in a different language or a different location, they're dubbing straight over the voice of the actors.
Yeah.
Every time they say Taco Bell, it goes Pizza Hut, and it always, always looks horrible.
Oh, well, any dubbing always
sounds
looks
so
horrible.
Janky.
So, meanwhile, Simon Phoenix is at the museum, the only place to see guns, and there's a cringe moment where he sees some Asians walk by, and he goes, ching chong, ching chong, and I felt very uncomfortable in that moment. But
would you felt uncomfortable when this movie came out?
Yeah, this is a conversation we always have, and I say no. I say
back then, no.
I say
back
then, anybody no. who saw this movie in the theaters laughed at that part.
And we had this come up in our UHF episode as well.
Oh.
Because RJ Fletcher is the bad guy, and he says a couple unsavory things. And so Colin's defense was, well, he is the bad guy. And in this case, yeah, it is, with 2020 eyes, it's problematic to hear something like that. But yes, it does come up all the time that in the 90s, unfortunately, this would have been something that would have been more accepted. But while he is trying to break the glass to the gun case, an employee of the museum comes up to him and asks, "Fellow greetings, what seems to be your boggle?" And Simon sizes the guy up and uses him as a human battering ram to smash the glass. Now, I'm no physics expert, but that doesn't seem quite possible to me, that a soft human body would be able to shatter this glass that he wasn't able to kick a hole through.
Well, I mean, force times is mass times acceleration, larger mass. Plus, you'd be able to accelerate a human body faster than you could kick a foot.
Couldn't he have just run and jumped at it then?
He could have, but then he might risk personal injury.
Oh, there you
if
go.
If anybody asked me what my boggle was, I'd probably try and throw them through a window too.
That's a good point. So now he's armed, and Simon poses the question, this is the future, where are the phaser guns? Now, this is why I did all that math earlier, and wanted to highlight that math. Okay, last murder happened in 2016. You know, the big one, the big earthquake happened in 2010. So that's only 22 years earlier, and this whole utopian society has built around. When did they make those phaser guns? Were those phaser guns back from 2010 or just before?
They're actually listed as, they're rail guns. I forget the actual name. I haven't watched the movie in a while, but they're like something rail 20 whatever.
Oh, so maybe I missed the date with
The date is on the gun.
Oh.
You know what? Here, you guys keep talking.
Okay.
I'm going to look that up.
And why are all the guns fully operational? Like, including the cannon that he fires. Like, wouldn't you remove the firing pins if you were putting them in a museum? And live ammo? Why are they keeping fucking live ammo around in this museum? It just, are they that trusting in the future?
Well, I think it's they're living in a world that has no violence. It's like when it's like, I don't know. I guess guns are more dangerous than like spears. But when you go back into a museum, you see spears and swords and that kind of stuff. Like, there's no threat that someone's just gonna break the glass, grab a sword, and start like.
That's true.
You would not expect that to happen.
Yeah.
So it might be a similar type situation.
I also like in this, though, when he's collecting the guns, he tells one of the mannequins, "Excuse me, Rambo, I need to borrow this." And little sly wink and a thumbs up to the camera there.
It's funny because I read that in the Middle East, this movie is actually called Rambo the Destroyer because of the Sylvester Stallone. They just play it off as another Rambo movie because Rambo was so popular.
Oh, my. At this point, John Spartan, Lenina Huxley, and Alfredo Garcia have arrived at the museum. Spartan leaves the other two behind and goes on in his search. You know, I'll be back in 10 minutes. He really doesn't believe in backup. Simon has ended up using his future gun. Once John gets in there, you know, he's blown the door open with the cannon, and they get into a gun battle because Spartan happens to find one of the guns that he's dropped. And yeah, he uses the future gun, which I couldn't help notice takes way longer to charge the first time than it did the second time. But he and John end up in a gunfight, which takes place in an excavated section of LA that's underneath the museum. Simon escapes, and he comes across Dr. Raymond Cocteau and Associate Bob in the garden, and Simon tries to shoot him but can't. This is where we get a little information that Dr. Cocteau, the savior of this utopian society, is a little shady. Seems he has implanted hypnotic suggestions in Simon's subliminal rehab program. That is definitely not rehabilitation. So John Spartan comes on the scene, Simon runs away, and then John just kind of gives up the chase. Like Simon runs away, he hops through bushes and everything like that, and then John Spartan comes running up, and he gets as far as the bushes, and he just stops. God damn it, I just lost him. You know, it's, well, he's not that, he's just on the other side of those bushes. He's not very far away. Why have you given up the chase? But as a thank you, Dr. Cocteau invites John Spartan out to dinner at Taco Bell, which, as we mentioned, is the only restaurant that survived the franchise wars. And interestingly, I was actually eating Taco Bell the night that I watched this. Like, I was just craving Taco Bell that night, and I didn't even know that I was going to be watching Demolition Man that night. And then I'm like, oh no, I'll pop in Demolition Man. And then, oh yeah, all this Taco Bell stuff. In the car on the way, Lenina Huxley mentions that she has, on the way to dinner, she has perused some of John Spartan's newsreels in the Schwarzenegger Presidential Library, where we get kind of another eerie prediction of politics, unless Schwarzenegger was already talking in the 90s about running for governor.
But I don't think he was. I think this actually might have been the catalyst.
You think so?
Yeah,
because he actually wasn't governor until like 2003. Mm-hmm. So this is like a full year, 10 years before. That would be kind of interesting if that was the reason. We're now having dinner at the super swanky Taco Bell while a lounge singer sings jingles, and we see what the upper crust of this society looks like. So if Dr. Cocteau is credited as being the savior of this city, is it just San Angeles that looks like this? Or is all of North America, is he like the savior, or the whole world? Would Edmonton look like this? Like, or so, is it just San Angeles that's in this bubble of...
Is he like the Dr. Hinshaw or the Dr. Fauci of that time?
Medical examiner. No, I don't think he's that kind of doctor. But
it's true. Like, if this movie was made now, that would be something that they would have to explain so in depth. There would need to be a whole slide even before they go to the burning Hollywood sign explaining exactly like what is happening in the world.
A Star Wars type scroll in the beginning.
But in the 90s, you could just kind of like throw it out and be on your way. Simpler times.
So while they're eating and John's doing a terrible job of blending in, he has one of his hunches when he sees a couple of very non-upper crust looking guys sneaking around outside. Turns out his hunch was right because the guys outside are all part of a Taco Bell grocery heist. But before Spartan realizes what they're actually after, he beats the shit out of a few of them and first gets to say the line, "You're going to regret this for the rest of your life, both seconds of it." I counted to 8, by the way. But he scares them off and stops fighting when he sees that they're just starving. The food in those containers, are those something that it's like in Back to the Future where they rehydrate the pizza? Like, is this like dehydrated things that you add water to? Because those just look like...
I used to deliver food, and if you ever go to Tim Hortons, that's basically what you get at Tim Hortons now.
Simon pays a visit to Cocteau, where he has changed the light voice command to illuminate. Okay,
that's probably the most memorable point of the movie.
For what, me. Illuminate?
Illuminate and deluminate. Yeah, and then he throws him in the fire.
Yeah, I must say I was tempted to make the same change on my Alexa at home.
Yeah, anybody who has like a home automation system should just change it to illuminate. Deluminate.
He tells Cocteau that he needs some more goons thawed from the cryo prison. Lenina drives John home, and seeing him in action, even better than on Laserdisc, she says, has given her another lady boner because she asked John if he'll have sex with her. And I think it goes without saying that what we are given as sex in 2032 is fucked up with its Dr. Xavier-style cerebro helmets that they have to put on. But I have a couple legitimate questions about sex in 2032. Okay, so this thing, it stimulates the pleasure centers in your brain. Is everything in your brain? Because, I mean, realistically, your body is going to have physiological responses. So, or,
you might want to have like a napkin or like a...
Well, he has a towel, but I always assume that towel was for sweat. But like, you know, yeah, all pretense thrown aside, is he jizzing in his pants all...
I think it's closer to basically jerking off with an Oculus Rift.
But this is a society that is so terrified of fluid transfer that they don't even kiss. COVID, I hear ya. But because after AIDS there was NRS, and after NRS there was UBT, but if fluid transfer really grosses them out this much, how do you masturbate in the future, right?
Like privately. Well,
obviously, but would you be using one of these helmets as well? Because like, if this helmet doesn't do the same thing that your hand is going to do, like, this cerebro helmet thing would make a whole lot more sense to me if there was, like, an extra piece that attached to your genitals somehow. You know, like...
Oh, that's, like... that's a bad visual. If you've ever watched the show, on Amazon, there's a show called Upload where, like, people... Mm.
Yes, the sex suits?
Yeah, you can download your consciousness into this virtual world, but then if you have somebody else who's still in the real world... They have these sex suits that they put on, and it, like...
But you can rent the sex suits. Yeah, that was a good show. I enjoyed Upload quite a bit, actually. So, John hates future sex. I don't blame him. He tries to kiss her for real, and he gets thrown out. Goes back to his apartment and starts knitting because his behavioral engineering has made him a seamstress, which I love. And he sits and watches security footage that he has received from Lenina.
But before that, we just have this random, like, naked woman show up, like, a wrong number call. Like,
yeah,
they had to put some tits in the movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Basically, I think, what it came down to.
Yeah. Oh, wrong number, click. But video calling, they got that right.
Yeah.
They knew that people would be sending naked pictures of each other in the future. But he realizes, watching this security footage of the museum garden, that Cocteau is, in fact, dirty.
Could you say, like, how bad of a... quote-unquote, because I'm doing air quotes, quote-unquote villain Cocteau is, that he wouldn't scrub the security footage? Like, how is this? That bothered me. Well, I don't even know why. Yeah, I was just it's sloppy villain work.
Even the fact that, yeah, they were easily able to look up what Simon's rehab programming was.
Yeah, like, it's access denied, and then she just has to do an override, and all of a sudden, oh,
click,
okay.
Click, I'm a cop.
And she's not even, like, a high-ranking cop.
No! She's an officer.
She's a beat cop.
Yeah. The next day, John meets up with Lenina to go to work, and he has knit her an apology sweater. A quick look at Simon's rehab program, we're right here anyway, shows that he was given all sorts of new skills, like murder, death, kill, and...
mini martial arts.
All sorts of things.
Terrorism and all this stuff, and...
If only there had been the line, I know Kung Fu.
Urban. I'm pretty sure one of them is urban comp. One of them is martial arts.
Yeah.
And then another one is like urban combats.
Yeah, and all the security clearances for everything. So Spartan decides to confront Cocteau about it, and it doesn't quite go the way that he wants because Cocteau orders Lenina to return him to cryo prison. But this is kind of an empty threat because Lenina Huxley is just a big pushover, and John has the idea to go down to the sewers instead to find out.
Before that, don't we have the classic line when they're in that room and after he shoots all there, and I can't remember what Cocteau says to him, but his response is just to get fucked, and then he shoots the the dispenser.
The verbal morality code dispenser. Yeah, get fucked. I wish I had a better Sylvester Stallone impression. John has the idea to go down to the sewers to find Edgar Friendly, to find out why Simon wants to kill him. And so he is joined by Lenina Huxley, against her orders, and Alfredo Garcia. They come across the home of the Wasteland Scrap, where John gets a chance to have a burger and a beer. He's loving it. Ba 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 ba.
Rat.
When Lenina asks him, just don't ask where the meat comes from. Do you see any cows around here? Great line. Fantastic line. And yeah, it turns out to be a rat burger. We now finally get to properly meet Edgar Friendly, who is played by stand-up comedian Dennis Leary from movies like Judgment Night, Draft Day, The Ref. He was Captain Stacy in The Amazing Spider-Man. He was on the show Rescue Me and, of course, Ice Age. He was Diego, the saber-toothed tiger. And, of course, the singer of one of my favorite go-to karaoke tunes, The Asshole Song.
That was 93, I think, was peak Leary.
Yeah.
He was.
That was No Cure for Cancer.
Yeah.
How did I say? Dennis Leary was before my time. That was like, was he around the same time as like Jeff Foxworthy was super
no,
huge?
No, Jeff Foxworthy was bigger after.
Okay.
Yeah, this was about the time when George Carlin was
getting old.
Yeah,
Dennis Leary was like the George Carlin. He's gonna pick up what George Carlin did.
George Carlin. I love George Carlin, but yeah, he was starting to get a little bit just grumpier and more senile towards the end there. Where yeah, this is where. This was the fresh, new, angry comedian coming in.
Okay.
So he doesn't take very long to convince that these three cops are not here to take him in, and they're just as against Cocteau as he is. Dennis Leary gets an opportunity to drop a very Dennis Leary-esque rant on the cops, very reminiscent of his rant in the middle of his Asshole Song, You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get me a...
It basically comes down to, yeah. I want a freedom burger.
I want a freedom... and standing right next to him, playing Wasteland Scrap number two, or I guess a couple people over from him, is the subject of this week's BitPlayer Spotlight! So we are now 8 episodes into our show. I feel like it's time to share a personal anecdote. When I was 16, I appeared in a Canadian television show called Jake and the Kid, where I played the character Kid Number One. The next season, I was brought back for another episode and given the name Marcus Rouleau. However, that scene was cut from that episode. But if you look up my name on IMDb, that role is actually credited to someone else with the same name, who was part of the crew in movies like Passchendaele, Brokeback Mountain, Burn Your Maps. So my only film credit is given to the wrong Sean Wells. I even tried contacting IMDb to fix it with no luck. So if any of our listeners know how to make that happen, I'd be grateful. So as someone who once played a Kid Number One, this is why I have such an affection for these bit players and movies. So this week I take a look at Demolition Man's Wasteland Scrap Number Two, who is played by Thomas Jacob Black, a man born August 28th, 1969. Okay, I've done the psych out thing twice now. First with Tobey Maguire in Episode 2, The Wizard, and with Will Wheaton in Episode 5, The Last Starfighter. I'll cut to the chase. Jack Black is in this movie as one of Edgar Friendly's goons. I'm sure almost everyone knows who Jack Black is. You've seen him in movies like School of Rock, Nacho Libre, High Fidelity, Orange County, Shallow Hal, Enemy of the State, King Kong, and the new Jumanji films. He's also someone I've seen in concert with his band Tenacious D. I thought I'd just focus on a little of the early Jack Black. He was born in Santa Monica, California, and raised in Hermosa Beach, California. His parents divorced when he was 10, and he moved to Culver City, California. In 1982, at the age of 13, he appeared in a commercial for the Activision game Pitfall, which was one of my favorites on my Intellivision when I was a kid. For high school, he attended private schools and ended up moving on to UCLA, although he dropped out in his sophomore year to pursue a career in entertainment. While he was there, he joined the Actors Gang, which was a theater troupe founded by UCLA students, including UCLA alumni Tim Robbins. So leaving school seemed to be a good decision, because even though he didn't really break out as a household name until 2000 or so, he was super busy leading up to Demolition Man. His first screen credit was actually back around the time of his Pitfall commercial in 1984, in an episode of The Fall Guy, where he played young Colt's friend. But upon leaving college in the 90s, he was in something called Our Shining Moment, where he played Teenage Boy. In 1992 episodes of Golden Palace, which was a Golden Girls spinoff, playing Taxi Driver, and Great Scott, which we mentioned in the Wizard episode, because that was a Tobey Maguire show where he played Ray. But getting cast in the Tim Robbins movie Bob Roberts later that year. And then in 1983, he played a skinhead in an episode of Life Goes On, and a couple other movies, Marked for Murder, which is a Don Johnson, where he played Car Thief, and Airborne, which I've never heard of. It's a surf and rollerblade movie, which has Seth Green in it. He played Augie in that. And then finally, Demolition Man, where he played Wasteland Scrap number 2. He definitely paid his dues in these performances, plus carried on with much of the same numbered characters or job title characters or no last name characters for the rest of the 90s. But this is why I wanted to share my little anecdote up at the top, because as someone who has been a numbered character, even if I didn't get my IMDb credit for it, I appreciate the people that have to put in their time with these kind of characters. And I've said it before, but never discount the small parts, because you never know who they'll end up being. And that is BitPlayer Spotlight.
I was really hoping you were going to say that Jack Black stole your credit.
Oh, that would be even better, wouldn't it? But we even talked about Jack Black a little bit last week in Never Ending Story, because he was in Never Ending Story 3. Yeah. That was one of those 90s where he was trying to find a little more of his footing.
Never Ending Story 3. Wow. I'm so old. I remember the first one. I've seen the first one. That's it.
Oh, okay. Simon Phoenix and his new gang have found them in the sewers, and he's excited because he gets 2 for the price of 1. But even though he has the element of surprise, he doesn't take his time to aim his weapon at them. Like, they just fire off randomly in their direction. Like, I don't understand why they don't take a second.
For, like, 10 seconds about how stupid is it when you have a violent criminal from the past who's like, I'm not being violent enough right now. Can you, like, thaw out more of my violent friends? How's that a good idea?
But, well, he does specifically tell Dr. Cocteau that he doesn't want murderers. So he's just...
He doesn't want uppity folk from New York.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. He does mention that as well. So he was selective, but these guys seem like they're murderers because, like, later on, one of them straight up murders Cocteau.
Which was a brilliant move. Yeah. I mean, we can get to that later.
We will, absolutely.
And with the exception of Jesse Ventura, they're also all, like, ethnic or visible minorities, which... questionable.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up in a little bit here, but yeah, I definitely noticed that the future is still pretty whitewashed. You know, even a movie that was from the 90s, it's still, yeah, the movie's still a little whitewashed until you get the bad guys. But okay, so yeah, they found John Spartan and Edgar Friendly, and yeah, they don't take aim. They just start firing randomly in their direction. And for some reason, even though there aren't guns in the future, John Spartan has a seemingly endless supply of ammo as well, firing back at him.
To go back to the whole thing with John Spartan's daughter, in this scene, you'll notice he, like, grabs this girl, one of the scraps, and, like goes under a table to protect her from cover. And in the original, like, script, that girl was meant to be his daughter.
Oh, really?
And she shows up again at the end, but all the stuff about her being his daughter gets cut.
This could have been a 4-hour movie.
Yeah. I suppose so. Once again, Simon, like, there's a bunch of scuffles, but once again, Simon escapes. But Spartan notices that there's a service elevator, so he uses it to take Edgar Friendly's 1970 Oldsmobile 442 to the surface, where it happens to come up in an Oldsmobile dealership. But I don't understand the mechanics of this elevator. Shouldn't there be something above it that's actually pulling it up, or is would it all be hydraulics from below?
It makes no sense.
Yeah.
However, that car, because it's a movie car, sold an auction, I think, for $90,000.
Huh.
It's an old Oldsmobile 442, and they're worth a lot of money. This one was banged up, but it was in Demolition Man, and it sold for a lot of money.
So they bought it with, like, the holes still in the windshield and everything? Okay. Sure. Why not?
The fresh glass.
I wish I had $90,000 to spend on a car that was purposely beat up. But we get a thrilling car chase through the streets of San Angeles with Spartan leaping from one car to another and a fight that takes place in the cop car with Simon Phoenix overriding voice commands so that he can do dangerous things to him. And then he ends up throwing Simon Phoenix out of the car, and the auto drive and the self drive are all disengaged, and Spartan ends up crashing the car, and the car fills with secure foam. And we do get, after this, after he gets out of the car, another reference to his seamstress abilities. I would have liked more references to his seamstress abilities, but yeah, Lenina Hexley says, "You're bleeding." And he goes, "I can fix that. Just give me a needle and thread." And did I really just say that?
I would have liked them to use something where, in, like, the midst of battle, it's like he really needs something to,
like, MacGyver
to get to
type.
Phoenix, so he's like
stabs him in the throat with
all of a sudden his seamstress abilities come into play, and he
knits up a noose and strangles
future Spider-Man, but with yarn.
So yeah, now we get the meeting between Simon and Cocteau, where Simon finally finds that loophole in his ability to kill Cocteau by getting someone else from his gang to kill him. So, like you said before, brilliant move. Associate Bob jumps over to his side, and Spartan and Lenina end up showing up, and we find out that Lenina is pretty badass. She learned to fight from Jackie Chan movies. So this is where I realized, so I was talking about whitewashing a minute ago, but this is where I realized that Lenina Huxley's pants are really tight. Right? Like, you know, like they're doing some great ass work on Lenina Huxley here. So I went back and I watched for the other cops, because all the cops that you see, they all have, like, cargo pants on.
Cop pants.
yeah, cop pants. But you go back into the precinct and all the other women, and there's only, like, two or three women in the entire precinct, but they're all wearing skirts. So she's actually the only one wearing pants, but they're, like, stretch pants with no pockets. And I just, it's like, I felt gross with the fact that they sexualized her so much more than all the other characters. And that's where, when I brought this up, I was also going to bring up the fact that there's like one black cop, and there's the one Hispanic cop, and there's the one Asian woman cop, and there's very few other people. And then, like you said, all the minorities are part of Simon Phoenix's crew, or there's Simon Phoenix.
It was the era of extreme, like, female sexualization.
Yeah.
That time, like, other movies around the time, like The Mask, when
Cameron Diaz
walks into that bank with that red dress.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
that's a memory I have. Two Days in the Valley. I mean, yeah. Charlize Theron. Oh, like, no, oh, yeah. God. Like,
yeah.
Sandra Bullock is just...
Oh, in The Mask, she was hot in The Mask.
Yeah.
Like, Cameron Diaz, that was when Cameron Diaz was peak Cameron Diaz. And then she got all weird and bony.
I was also, like, really, like, super teenager at that point. So that helps.
That helps. Yeah, absolutely.
You brought up Jackie Chan.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know who was originally planned to play the bad guy in this movie?
Was it Jackie Chan?
It was Jackie Chan.
Huh.
Do you know who's planned to play the good guy in the movie? Or the Stallone part?
Was it Wesley Snipes?
Nope.
Oh.
Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Oh. Yikes.
So if you watch the movie, and Lenina Huxley is supposed to be played by What's her name?
Point Break.
Yeah, the Point Break chick.
I don't know how I would have felt about Jean-Claude Van Damme in the lead role.
Lori Petty.
There, yeah.
She was fired after 2 days, though, because she had bad... Her and Sly did not get along.
This was Sandra Bullock's big break. This is why she got into speed, I think.
So I wonder if, like, when she won the Oscar for Blindside, did she end up thanking this chick for the trajectory of her career?
Well, it's funny because Sandra Bullock actually got nominated for a Golden Raspberry Award for, like, worst supporting actress for this movie.
Yeah. Well, and the year that she won for Blindside, she won... Also, a Golden Raspberry for All About Steve, which was from the same year. Right. So she actually went and accepted her Golden Raspberry Award and then went to the Oscars the next night and won for Blindside. So yeah, after the fight between Lenina with John and Lenina with the bad guys, the henchmen, they see that Cocteau has been murdered and Simon has set the cryo prison to thaw everyone. And we're at the cryo prison and Simon is excited that all these people are coming and he sees that Jeffrey Dahmer is one of those guys. I love this guy. And then, you know, once everything's set in motion, he just straight up murders the rest of his gang.
A fun, I don't know, blooper goof that I found about that is that Jeffrey Dahmer actually died in 1994. So it was like between the release of the movie and when it's set to take place.
Yeah. So meanwhile, Lenina, kicking ass, gets her rewarded with getting knocked unconscious by John Spartan, and he goes after Simon at the prison alone. Send a maniac to catch a maniac. How'd he get his beret back? Where has he been keeping that?
It's called a prison pocket.
Yeah, he kept it in the old prison wallet. I just, you know, this is the first time since the opening scene that he's got his beret back, and I mean, obviously he has to be the Demolition Man again, but it just, you know, he's not driving his own car. Where was he keeping this in the pocket until, you know, the climax of the movie?
Did it get frozen with him?
No, because he was naked in there. Yeah.
But you can't tell because he's all in the fetal position. So maybe he had like three or four berets.
He had it in his prison wallet, like you said. Spartan drives the car through the front door of the prison, and we get another exciting fight scene between John and Simon with lines that call back to the opening scene, like, is it cold in me? Is it cold in me? Fuck me.
One day you're gonna deliver one of these lines.
Probably. I know, right? Is it cold in here, or is it just me? To the wench! Okay, sorry. Call back to last week when I fucked up royally on another line. Yeah, is it cold in here, or is it just me? Which Simon says, good memory. Even though, like, yeah, come on.
Simon says.
But it's, for them, it's been like 2 months.
Yeah.
Right? In theory, except like John Spartan at dinner says that he was conscious the whole time. But, you know.
It's like the reverse of Interstellar. How long have you been sitting? 7 years.
So we get another exciting fight in the cryo prison between Simon and John Spartan, and it ends up with Simon getting frozen and his head getting kicked off, and the foreshadowing prophecy is fulfilled. The cryo prison gets destroyed. Everyone is wondering what's going to happen next. They join forces with Edgar Friendly to paint the town, as he says, literally, we need to go out there and spray paint everything. Lenina Huxley shows up and gets kissed. She asks, are all fluid transfers this much fun? To which John Spartan says, better. She says, oh my. And then she becomes the aggressor in the kiss. And we end up with our credits with the Demolition Man song, which I was fascinated to find out is sung by Sting.
Yep.
I had no idea this song even existed, let alone that it was Sting.
It was actually a pop. I don't know if it like hugely charted, but it was actually a big song. Maybe not in Canada, but
I heard that he re-recorded it for the movie. So maybe they added, maybe because it's a little bit more rockier, less pop.
Yeah,
for the credits,
more futuristic,
more synthesizers.
So there we go. That's Demolition Man. Now, Colin, Tyler, on IMDb, it scored 6.7 out of 10. It has a Metascore from the critics of 34. On Rotten Tomatoes, it has 60% on, 60% fresh on the tomato meter, and an audience rating of 66%. Yeah, so everything kind of around 65, you know, somewhere in the middle, mid-60s.
It's in just a slightly above average movie.
Yeah.
It's fun to watch. It's one of the most fun movies I think you can watch, even today, and it holds up. Like, yeah. There's old action movies. I think this kind of slots in with, like, the Die Hards, the Lethal Weapons.
That action comedy, which was is a really great genre. But before we get to what we really think about it, Colin, did anyone else have opinions on this film?
Yes, let's go to the critics to see what the critics of the time had to say when this film came out. So, we'll start off with David Anson from Newsweek. He says, Demolition Man is a movie that should have been fun and isn't.
Ouch.
Ow. Emmanuel Levy from Variety says, a noisy, soulless, self-conscious pastiche that mixes elements of sci-fi, action, adventure, and romance, then pours on a layer of comedy replete with Hollywood in-jokes.
Can I just inject for like 2 seconds? Anybody who uses the word pastiche, nobody wants to...
Yeah. You don't want to hear what you have to say.
You're not getting invited to parties.
Unless that's your party trick.
Philippa Bloom with Empire Magazine says, this futuristic comedy depends on your opinion of Stallone and his unapologetic, popcorn-pleasing, action no-brainers. To be fair, this is one of his better ones.
Oh.
And then Richard Schickel with Time Magazine says, ultimately, the script's often sharp social satire is drowned out by the noise and confusion. It is also undercut by casting virtually all the psychopathically murderous criminals as minority group members, which we talked about a lot. So that's what the critics had to say.
Nice. Okay, so we've got mid-60s is kind of where everything is sitting, except for that Metascore from IMDb. Like, I don't know why the critics on IMDb always hate the movies that we watch. Like, that 34 is an anomaly, but...
They're nerds.
This is a movie that isn't critics-friendly. I'm actually surprised that the audience score is not higher. I would have thought the audience score would have been in the high 70s, like, low 80s.
Yeah, but this movie, it has the same kind of vibe as, like, Speed, which came out the year after.
Yeah.
Like, it's just a non-stop action with jokes. Funny, with jokes movie. And that was, it's like the mid-90s. That's what everything was then.
It's the Marvel formula.
Yeah. Well, I agree with Tyler. Like, it does fit in really well with the Lethal Weapons, the Rush Hours, and those types of movies. It's kind of unfortunate to me that it didn't become a franchise. Like, I think there's...
I've heard there's still plans for a sequel in the works.
They should do a prequel.
Yeah, or a prequel.
I want to see a movie about the big one in 2010.
Yeah, I think there could have been more.
Yeah,
you could have made a prequel in 2010 where they still have Stallone, but then you realize they just wipe his memory after, so he doesn't remember by the time it's 2032.
I think they can probably take all of the actors and do, like, the really bad... what was the Netflix gangster movie that came out summer? I forget the name.
The Irishman?
The Irishman. Yeah. Where they just CGI'd everybody's face and it looks really creepy. So you could have, like, a really creepy, young-looking Stallone. And I mean, Sandra Bullock probably still looks the same.
Yeah, I don't think she looks much different. Stallone's definitely looking old these days.
I think most of the actors are... Who are any of them dead?
Oh, well, probably the guy that played Zachary.
The police chief guy?
He's still alive, yeah.
He's still cooking?
he's the guy that I said was in Daredevil.
Yeah.
So, and he was in 24, like, he was on several seasons of 24, and that ended, what, like, 8 years ago now? Yeah, no, he's still kicking around. So, general consensus from you guys, I think I'm happy with a mid to high 70s. Like, that's where I would go with it. It's still a very, very enjoyable movie for me.
Yeah, I still really liked it. I would put it at high 70s, low 80s, like I said. I didn't get to mention it earlier, but I was really impressed by Stallone's jackedness in this movie. I think because I've only seen him older, where he's like he's still obviously jacked, but He's like Marvel jacked in this movie in the 90s, which I feel like was really hard to do.
Yeah.
Well, this was cliffhanger era too.
Yeah.
Which was Rambo, you know, like it or not, that was a pretty big movie. Cliffhanger, I think, was Stallone's biggest movie. His most successful movie, monetarily.
I was reading that this movie was kind of like, it ended up being of the type of movie that kind of revived his career. Like, I don't know much about his career, but...
Yeah. So, okay, so we like it more than everyone seems to on Rotten Tomatoes and IMDb. So, yeah, still very enjoyable for me, still very...
Wesley Snipes, still a badass. Too bad he got into all his, like, tax troubles and... I don't know if he ended up going to prison, but still. I feel like Wesley Snipes had more potential than he ultimately was able to.
If you look at the star power that was in this, like, from our point in time right now, back then, the star power that was in this movie.
Yeah.
It's insane.
It is. Yeah.
Like,
absolutely.
There's so many huge, huge, huge stars. And it was like, back then, it was like, I think they were... bitching and moaning because the movie cost like $58 million to make.
Yeah, back then it was Stallone was the star of this movie. Mm-hmm. And even Wesley Snipes wasn't quite big yet.
Yeah.
But he was obviously in Passenger 57 before this movie came out. That much I know. Well, that's Demolition Man, and that's our show for this week. A big thank you to our guest this week, Tyler Warawa. Tyler, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a blast.
Yeah, man.
I've had a good time. it's fun, like, just sitting around talking about old movies.
If you like that show, one thing you can do to really help us out on the business end is go to Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or whatever app you listen to your podcasts on. Give us 5 stars if that option is available to you. It's not available on Spotify, but of course we're available on there too. It doesn't matter what you say in those 5-star reviews. You can tell us what the 3 seashells do. It doesn't matter. Just as long as you give us those 5 stars and help us get noticed, drive us up those charts, it's what helps.
And if you want to get in touch with us, you can contact us at iusedtolikethisone@gmail.com. Check out our website, www.iusedtolikethisone.com. There you can find links to all our social medias. We got Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Check us out on there to see what we'll be watching next so you can watch the movie before we talk about it.
I Used to Like This One is created by, hosted by, and produced by Sean Wells and Colin Stewart. It is edited by Sean Wells, music by Lyndon Carter. Look for his band Carter in the Capitals anywhere you listen to music. Thanks for listening. And join us next week when we take a look at another movie on I Used to Like This One.